Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
I'm delighted to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Stephen Canty, who was once a United States Marine and is now a filmmaker based here in Charlottesville, Virginia, and who is making a film called Once a Marine. Stephen Canty, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Hey, how are you?
I'm very interested in hearing your story, which was featured in an article in the Seaville Weekly newspaper that's online that people should also read. How and why and when did you join up?
I joined in 2007 at the young age of 17 years old. I initially had planned on joining at 18 when I got out of high school, but something just changed halfway through my high school, my senior year, and I just decided that I had to go then and there. And I had the credits to leave because I had enough advanced classes under my belt that I had the credits to leave just in the middle of the year and went to boot camp at 17.
Aren't minors not supposed to be recruited? Isn't that an international standard?
I begged my mom to sign the paperwork. There is an exception they can make. I don't think they can send someone under the age of 18 to Afghanistan or Iraq, but you can go through boot camp. And by the time I finished, I was 18 a month later.
And so did you join up because of the lifestyle of a Marine or because of the mission of wanting to go take part in wars in Iraq or Afghanistan that you believed in?
I believed in the mission. I remember being an idealist. I told my parents if I could just make one Iraqi child's life better, then I had done my job. And I really believed in what we were doing over there.
You were deployed, however, to Afghanistan.
Yep. I think all of us joined think we were going to go to Iraq. We all saw September 11th as kids, and then all the guys I joined or served with all said, yeah, man, I joined to go to Iraq, and then we went to Afghanistan.
And was it what you expected?
I don't think anything can prepare you for what combat is like. Luckily, my first deployment was comparatively tame. We didn't lose anyone from my company, but Afghanistan is, it's almost another planet. The culture, the customs, the geography, the flora and fauna are just completely different than America, and it takes, some people have trouble getting used to it, but I looked at it as an adventure, and I started to kind of, a lot of people say, oh, I can't wait to go home, and I just realized that that place was my home for 7 months. You know, both deployments were just, I kind of looked at it as this is where I live, and this is what I have to do is be here.
You were deployed twice to Afghanistan.
Yep, once in 2008, and then again in 2009 through the summer of 2010.
The second deployment was harder?
The second deployment was a lot tougher. Our first deployment was part of, I believe, a kind of media push to divert attention away from Iraq. So they sent us to a relatively small town in Afghanistan and told us to clear out the Taliban. They gave us air assets, artillery, everything. And within about 2 weeks, the fighting was over, and the rest of the deployment was like a summer vacation. But the second deployment, it was intense fighting until the day that we left. And it didn't seem like we were able to get rid of the Taliban. I mean, we didn't have those same assets. It felt to me like the nature of war had changed.
Had changed from what to what?
Well, the first deployment was very kinetic. It was go in there, destroy anybody that shoots at you. I think there are relatively few civilians there. But Marja was a city. My second deployment was a city versus the first deployment was more of a rural area. So we weren't able to use those same assets. And you'd go out, a squad of 10 people, and get ambushed. And you can't call for air support. You can't call for even artillery smoke. You're just out there on your own. And that was very tough after a while.
It's almost appropriate, this incredible rainstorm that I think my microphone is picking up right now in the background. I can't even see out the window. You say the first deployment you saw as essentially a public relations maneuver?
I'm not really sure, but what I do know is that there wasn't much going on in Iraq at that point. It seemed like we were kind of waiting around for casualties, waiting for the enemy to come to us, I guess. I'm not really sure. I wasn't there, but there was an unusually high amount of reporters and press for what was a relatively small mission. I think it was exciting, and I think there were a lot of people there because the push was interesting, but I think it was part of an effort to kind of show, hey, look, we're doing something in the war on terror. There's, you know, fighting going on.
You've used the word adventure. There were positive parts to the experience, I'm sure. Exhilaration and solidarity and sacrifice. So what were the positive or the best aspects, if any, of your experience?
The best aspects, I would say, would be the adventure, the travel. I learned to speak a little bit of Farsi and Pashtun. We ate local food. We learned a lot. It was just a time of great excitement. You know, your life is stripped down. It's just a survival. But I think in that, there's a certain amount of, there's just something very powerful about that, is you're just able to totally live day to day. And yes, the consequences are terrible and horrifying, but in some ways it's almost liberating to realize that you don't have anything other to do than, you know, make it home and, you know, fight alongside some of the closest people you'll ever be, you know in your life. It's past brotherhood. It's the people that you're there with are just, they know more than my brother does about me. They know more than my family does about me. I can depend on them for my life, and I think that's a powerful experience. And then when you realize that there's 20, 30, 50, 100 guys that are like that, you can depend on for your life, that's a really inspiring thing to be a part of. It's really difficult to put into words. But like I said, Afghanistan is just a completely different country, and that was kind of enthralling. It was unlike anything I'd ever done before, and I mean, seeing a pomegranate orchard and drinking mango juice and things like that, that's a really unique experience.
And what about the worst part of the experience? What was the most horrific?
I would say that the most horrific part of the experience is losing your friends, and then seeing children get hurt, seeing civilians get hurt, and not being able to do anything about it. And there's a certain truth. You know, one time a buddy of mine and I were just doing something really trivial. We were trying to put shade on this building that we lived in. And across the street, there's Afghan police there. They had a little police post, and these kids walked up, and they were asking for candy and stuff. And I think the Afghan police were giving them banana chips or something, just kids being kids, wanting snacks. And all of a sudden, the Taliban opened fire on that group of policemen with a little kid in front of them, and they shot a boy that was no older than 7 years old right through the face. And when I carried him, we were trying to put him on a helicopter to Kazovac to evacuate him. As I was carrying him down the road, on the other, his father steps out of a building and sees me carrying his son, and I remember him just sobbing. But later that night, he came to us and said, if you weren't here, you know, my son would still be alive. And I think there is a truth to that statement. I think the people of Afghanistan just don't want war anymore, but seeing things like that is very tragic, and it's hard to reconcile sometimes.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Stephen Canty, once a Marine and now a filmmaker, and making a film called Once a Marine, which you can learn about on Kickstarter if you search for Once a Marine, and you can help support the film. And the film is to be about coming back, the experience that you've had, Stephen, and your friends have had in coming back to the United States. Can you describe what that has been like?
The title of the film, Once a Marine, is kind of a play. There's a popular saying that says, once a Marine, always a Marine. But for the title of the film, Once a Marine, and then there's a period, is are we really always Marines? Are we really always going to have those mannerisms to be a part of that organization and be shaped by that experience? I think in some ways I definitely was shaped by the experience. When I came home, because I had joined at the age of 17, I had never paid bills. I had relatively little life experience outside of what I knew in the military. And when I got out, I was already enrolled up at Piedmont Virginia Community College. Less than a week after I got out of the military, I'd started classes there. And, you know, by all accounts, I think I was doing very well. I was going to school. I had a job. I had a girlfriend. But just something felt wrong to me. I always felt like I wasn't doing what I was supposed to, but I didn't know what that was. And as time went on, after I got out, I started to struggle with issues that I never really thought existed, or I didn't think that I had PTSD. I didn't think that I would struggle with that. But I was talking to a counselor at the VA, and he said, "Do you have PTSD?" And I said, "No." And he reads the symptoms to me, and I realized I had every single one of those symptoms. And I hung up the phone on him. I said, "No, I don't have PTSD. and hung up the phone, but I started to realize that I was struggling with some of those issues, PTSD and depression, and really no sense of purpose in my life. I really felt like I was floating, not sure of where I wanted to go or what I wanted to do, and really felt alone and had these issues that I was struggling with. And really, as much as supportive as my family was or my girlfriend at the time was, it's just they couldn't understand what I was going through, and I really couldn't articulate it because, you know, a couple months prior, I didn't think that I really had any problems. I just felt like something was wrong in my life, and then someone explains to me that I may have PTSD, and it wasn't that changed my experience now realizing that I had PTSD. It made sense, but it wasn't like it took away any of that pain or suffering. Now I knew what I had to deal with.
Has anything helped? In the article I read about your beginning to make this film and interviewing some of your friends who've come back from Afghanistan, they seem to thank you for interviewing them as if it were almost therapeutic. Has it been for you as well?
It has. The way that I dealt with loss, both of you know, two of the Marines that we lost in Afghanistan, and then two of my very close friends from the military, they died when they got back home. I think it was because they were living risky lives, living on the edge as a result of their deployments. But I dealt with loss by bottling up or ignoring it, I guess. I didn't go to people's funerals. I didn't really want to talk about any of that stuff. The film has really forced me to confront a lot of the things that I've been running from. In that interview process, it's like, some of the guys I interview, they thank me and they look at it as therapeutic, but for me, I am discussing things that I haven't thought about or talked to anybody about in years, and I think it's also therapeutic for me. It's really helped me kind of come to terms with some of the stuff. But what's interesting is that it doesn't really hit home so much during the interview for me as it does when I actually begin to edit the footage and kind of work with it and realize, like, this is your story as well. This kid is talking during an interview, but he's talking about losing one of his best friends, and that was one of your friends. And you have to kind of look at your life on a computer screen and organize it so that other people can understand it, and it helps me make sense of everything.
What kind of stories have people been telling you thus far in this process?
Well, one of my best friends from the military, his name is Darren Doss. He's actually going to be helping me with the project. He fell into heroin relatively quickly after he got out and struggled with that for the past 3 years. He's been clean now, but his story, I think, speaks for a lot of veterans that deal with drugs and drug addiction when they get home. My friend Mirza Mehmedovic that I interviewed has been trying to get a job as a police officer for 3 years. He joined the Marine Corps because he wanted to be a police officer when he got out. And because of his wounds in Afghanistan, he can't get a job. He has sustained a couple concussions, and he's having trouble, you know, finding his place. He's a father, got two kids, so now he really feels kind of powerless, I guess. I've had one of the guys tells me, he says, "Oh, I haven't been negatively affected in the transition at all. I think it's going just fine." And I said, "Yeah, man, but you told me you have nightmares of killing people every night." And he says, "Yeah." I said, "Wouldn't you say that's a pretty big issue to deal with in the transition?" He goes, "Maybe. I don't know." So some of these guys don't even think about this stuff, or they don't process it, but they carry it around. And the interviews are really a chance to get them talking and for them to kind of realize that, hey, man, maybe I've been doing... I've been covering this up, but maybe I should deal with some of these issues. The last guy that I interviewed drove all the way from Florida, essentially just to do an interview, and he talked about the day Smith was one of the Marines that we were with, the day Smith died, how he was too afraid to go hold his hand and comfort him when he died. There were five people working on Smith, but this kid that interviewed with me was his best friend, his best man at his wedding. He told his parents that he'd bring him home safely, and he says that for the rest of his life, he'll think about how he was too afraid to hold his friend's hand when he died. So, very, very powerful stories. Some of them are very heavy. A lot to deal with for them and for me, but I think I have a responsibility to tell this story.
Does the military give you any sort of preparation for dealing with this as you're getting out? How would you compare what the military does to prepare you for coming back with the training and preparation and conditioning that it gives you for heading out?
Well, things may have changed, but I remember getting combat stress classes. They say, you know, you're on your way home, they give you these classes, and they say, hey, for 6 months, your brain chemistry is different. It's going to return to normal after constantly being in combat. But they really dealt with those first few months, you know, hey, you're going to feel strange, you're going to feel normal. They talked to us a lot about alcohol, you know, drinking, but really nobody, PTSD was the final slide in the PowerPoint, and it was like, well, you know, PTSD, you might get to this point. It was like, if, you know, they showed a picture of a branch in all these PowerPoints during a storm, and a branch can bend, which was combat stress, and a branch that was broken was PTSD. But I think that was the extent of the training, is a couple PowerPoints, a couple classes in terms of, you know, group, I mean, 500 people classes, and they'd talk to entire company of Marines or something about these issues. And then besides that, we do a program called Steps and Taps, which is a week-long separation course. It's classes on how to write a resume and where to find jobs and things like that. But that's it. That's the extent of it. There's not any personal counseling. There is a they have changed some things. They do a post-deployment health reassessment. When I was in 2010, when we got home, our post-deployment health assessment was, you know, how much are you drinking? How much are you sleeping? Do you have any kind of health concerns? But there wasn't really a focus on mental health. And now they've added that in now, but those surveys are kind of a joke because it's a self-reporting survey, and you don't... A good example, a buddy of mine says he drinks 3 times a week, and then the next week he finds out that he's going to substance abuse rehabilitation program. So everybody, the word really quickly spreads, just say you never drink on there. So everybody goes, yeah, I never drink. And then you got guys that are alcoholics that could really maybe use some help, and they're like, nope, never drink. And they're avoiding those programs because they don't want to deal with the heavy-handedness or be branded or be labeled in a certain way. And there still is a stigma with a lot of this stuff in the military, especially the mental health issues.
Now, you're beginning to make a film about a war where a lot of the troops and maybe yourself engaged in some amateur filmmaking during the war. I mean, there's endless YouTubes and videos coming out, and I guess you've made a short video that's online with material that people shot while over there. Did your interest in making the film begin in Afghanistan? How did you get to this idea of making a documentary about this?
Well, I'd always wanted to do something creative for a living. I was always passionate about telling stories, but I never really thought film would be the means by which I told these stories. Basically, when we were in Afghanistan, a lot of people nowadays have small digital cameras, and they can take, you know, you can record things with them. So there is a lot of footage coming back from the war, and I just remember one day near the end of the deployment, I said, hey, I'd like to make a video of all this. We call them moat videos. They're supposed to be motivating to show, you know, combat and young Marines or young kids that don't know any better. They see them and they think, wow, that's awesome. And it is, even now, it does inspire something in me. But I took everybody's combat footage that was at our little outpost, and we threw that together. But I didn't think anything of making a film with it at the time. I also took over 3,000 pictures in Afghanistan, but the only thing I thought was one day I'm going to be old and I'll want to remember this, and I want to show my kids, my grandkids. But the film came about almost a year and a half after I got out. I had gotten more serious about my photography and bought a DSLR, a nice digital camera that was, it had the ability to take videos on it, and I started playing with that, and I filmed literally everything around me, and one day I just clicked. It was like, this is what I want to do. I started taking every job I could to get experience. I started volunteering to film anything under the sun, and here in Charlottesville, there's a lot of wacky things that you'll be asked to film. But one day, I decided, hey, you know, you got to make your own film, man. You want to be a filmmaker, you got to make your first film. But I didn't have access to the neighborhood kids, or I didn't have a lot of friends to work with. So I turned to the guys that I knew I could count on, the guys I served alongside in the Marine Corps. And I thought, hey, maybe we can do a documentary about what it's like to come home. But I planned on initially following just my friend who was a heroin addict and kind of telling his story. And just during the research phase, I started calling more people, and it was the first time that I talked to anybody in 2 years. And no matter where they were in life, whether they had a six-figure salary in a house with a pool or they were shooting 20 bags of heroin a day, they were all saying the same things. I miss everybody. I miss being in Afghanistan. I miss having a very clear purpose in life. I have trouble fitting in. I have trouble making friends. They were all saying these same things, and I realized that there was a story there. And I just decided that I'd like to... I started by doing interviews in my apartment, and I realized that there... After that first interview, I realized, hey, there's something really important here. But as I went on and did more and more interviews, people started using it as an outlet to kind of talk about things that they hadn't talked about. And the tone changed. It went from being, hey, I want to make my first film, I'm going to make it with my buddies, to I kind of stumbled into a really important and serious story. And I posted the trailer online just as a way to show people that I was actually making something. It's like, really, hey, Mom and Dad, like, your son is not just talking about being a filmmaker. He's trying to do something. But people saw it and started taking it seriously. I had Vietnam vets sending me messages on Facebook and said, hey, man, I saw your trailer. I want you to tell this story. This is important. No one's ever told this story. I even had nurses that said they've used the trailer alone to teach classes about PTSD. A corpsman that I was in with, the Marine Corps equivalent of a medic, they're actually through the Navy, but he says, hey, I'm teaching all my young guys about PTSD and combat stress by using your videos. And I started to realize that this was a serious thing. It was helping the guys that were a part of it. It was helping other people that had gone through similar experiences, and it was helping civilians to understand what we were going through.
Do you think that excitement and exhilaration and solidarity that all of the guys miss could be found somewhere other than war? Do you think it was in Tahrir Square in Cairo when people threw out the president of Egypt? Do you think if there were a massive effort to go to Fukushima and protect the world from nuclear radiation, that it could be there? Do you think that the positive aspects of war could be found without the horrible negative aspects?
Yes, I think in some ways, I think you can find a solidarity in service in other ways. I think there is a capacity for good in a lot of these guys, and it's actually a lot of them have grown up and matured, and now you hear guys saying, man, I love, like, children. I just want to teach children about their rights, and I want to teach children about what it's like to be an American and why it's important to vote and why it's important to, you know, you hear there's a little bit more altruism among everyone now, and I think that there could be positive outlets for some of that excitement and need for adventure and things like that. Unfortunately, I think it is something that's, I'm not sure if it's a cultural thing or if it's biological, it's just hardwired into us, but I think human beings have they have a killer instinct, unfortunately. And hopefully we can get past that as a species at some point. But I just remember being 16 and 17 years old and seeing those videos, like the video I made of all the combat footage, seeing those online and thinking, man, like that's so badass. And part of me, even knowing the high cost and knowing how horrible the results of all those bullets and explosions can be, something about seeing that in me kind of excites me in a way that very few things have. And really, filmmaking is the only thing that's excited me as much as combat. And that's why I'm really desperately pursuing that, is because I do want a healthy outlet. And I think that's the biggest issue that a lot of these guys struggle with, is that adrenaline and that purpose. And they each have to find it in a healthy way on their own. My buddy that was shooting heroin, a lot of it, he said, was about the excitement of, you know, the driving around with large amounts of heroin in the car, selling it, you know, kind of the, am I going to get caught, this risk, and those things kind of drew him to it, or kept him in it. And you really have to find positive and healthy outlets. Another friend of mine died driving 140 miles an hour down the road, and I just wonder what would have happened to him if maybe he was on a racetrack and he was doing it a healthy way, and what is the answer to this? And I think I have seen outfitters, kayak outfitters, snowboarding places, a lot of these sports places have said, hey, we got a weekend trip for veterans and stuff like that, and I think those are the kind of things that are really, really helpful. Is just getting these guys to get that rush and excitement back in their life in a healthy way.
We're just about out of time. This may be a yes or no question, but I have to ask. We've just gone into year number 13 with the U.S. military in Afghanistan. Would you encourage people to sign up and go there or not?
I can say yes or no, but it won't stop them from joining it. But I would encourage people to vote for politicians that will end this war and won't bring on more wars like this in the future. I think young men and women are always going to be drawn to service or, you know, combat or excitement. But I think that the people in charge of this country, they're supposed to be the ones looking out for these young Americans. They're the people that join putting their lives in their hands, and to have so many young American lives pissed away, it's a tragedy.
It is a tragedy indeed. We've been speaking with Stephen Canty. He's making a film. You can go to Kickstarter and search for Once a Marine. Stephen, thanks very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.